This is 1360 AM.
WNJC. Washington Township. Philadelphia. Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station. Brought to you from Forsyth Broadcasting. Or listen to us at WNJCRadio.com.
All right, welcome. This is your host, Will Hemingway, and you are listening to the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. No tinfoil hats here, no ranting rhetoric, simple, stoic, thoughtful enlightenment on training in risk management, preparedness, and proactive survival. Survival is every day, so live well. The Practice Preparedness Radio Show comes to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on WNJC 1360 AM, South Jersey, Philadelphia. As always, listen to us live on the internet via my website, practicepreparedness.com. We stream every time on TuneIn. Find the link on our website via the Listen Live button, or if you are in the Delaware Valley, you can listen live at 1360 on your AM radio. As always, you can stream the past shows. You will find them archived on the website under show notes or select one from the scrolling list on the website's right column. Thanks for joining us. I am your host, Will Hemingway. I want to stimulate your little gray cells. Let's get started. All right, welcome. This is your host, Will Hemingway, and you are listening to the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. No tinfoil hats here, no ranting rhetoric, simple, stoic, thoughtful enlightenment on training in risk management, preparedness, and proactive survival. Survival is every day, so live well. The Practice Preparedness Radio Show comes to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on WNJC 1360 AM, South Jersey, Philadelphia. As always, listen to us live on the internet via my website, practicepreparedness.com. We stream every time on TuneIn. Find the link on our website via the Listen Live button, or if you are in the Delaware Valley, you can listen live at 1360 on your AM radio. As always, you can stream the past shows. You will find them archived on the website under show notes or select one from the scrolling list on the website's right column. Thanks for joining us. I am your host, Will Hemingway. I want to stimulate your little gray cells. Let's get started.
All right. Good evening. It is 6:02 p.m. on April 11, 2017. Quite a world we live in. It is really something. And right now, we are seeing the roosters, well, the hens come home to roost, because all of those things that we've swept under the carpet and all those things that we have done nothing about are paying back the dividend for our lack of action or lack of proper action over the past 10 or so years. So, you know, over the past 2 months, myself and many of us in the group have been hearing from people talking about essentially their perception that they don't need to prepare anymore. Everything is peachy keen. The world's perfect, blah, blah. In fact, if you're looking around and you're listening to what's flying around, cut your way through the BS rhetoric of those Trotskyites who are PO'd that they didn't get what they wanted or lost their ground that they've been building for half a century to try to take things away from you. And there are some really really troubling things going on in the world. None of which, though, means anything that you can't handle if you are prepared, aware, and engaged in your environment. Remember, I know this doesn't sound like something you're used to hearing, because since the long-haired hippie freak druggies in the 60s started telling you that the man is holding you down, that anytime there's any rules or anything else, that means that, you know, you're being oppressed. But the fact of the matter is, really, what you must understand is that societal rules, whether it's in a club or whether it's in an organization or in a society, the fact of the matter is, you must have rules. There have to be, as someone I know that's close to me has beaten the drum about for years and years, you have to have boundaries. The fact of the matter is, without very clearly aligned boundaries, you will be in trouble. So you have to delineate. It's not plugged in, please. You have to delineate what the boundaries for the people are so that they know where they can go and where they can't. Because if not, you're going to be in trouble. That's just the reality of it. And the problem is that what we're seeing today, all right, leave it alone. What we're seeing today is a direct correlation to the fact that people think that they should have no rules and nobody telling them that they can't do anything. Remember, rules are by nature oppressive. All rules are oppressive, but oppression is relative. The question becomes, if you have no rules, what is your team? If you play football, it came on. If you play football, and you have no rules, and there are no rules about running outside of the lines, being off bounds, over the line, rushing, et cetera, it would be melee. It would be a disaster. It wouldn't even be worth watching. Not that it is, in my opinion, anyhow. But that said, the fact of the matter is, in the end, you have to have certain rules because you agree to compromise. That is the key. Compromise in order to give up a little bit of your freedom in order to maintain and have the overarching society protect all of your other freedoms. Without it, you'll have none in the end. Look around the world at places where there are very few rules or there are only a handful of people making the rules, and you will see. Look in most of the countries in the Arab states, for instance. What do they create? What do they export other than oil, which they're sucking out of the ground using foreign companies to do it? Or they brought foreign companies in, said they'd partner with them, then after they set it all up, they screwed them over and threw them out. One way or another, in the end, they are not making anything. They don't make cars. They don't make ships. They don't make planes. They don't build things. They barely grow anything for themselves. It's the individuals who have found a way to survive. And this is not where we want to be. So remember, back in the day, back in the 50s, there were discussions all the time about what it took to be a good citizen. In the teens, and in the 30s and 40s into the mid-50s, when there were shortages of food in the United States, yes, only not even 100 years ago, where there were shortages of food because we were at war. And because we were having problems in the homeland because of that, people came together to grow victory gardens. People came together to work together. And they gave up certain things. They gave up buying things with copper, buying things with steel, in order that there would be enough left in order to build our armaments up, in order to send it over with our troops so they didn't die unequipped. These are the realities of life. You give, you take. You give, you get in return. It's a quid pro quo. Not in the way of a dirty quid pro quo like you hear it used in the political standpoint, but in fact, quid pro quo used to be, I elect you because I want you to fight for me. I didn't elect you to fight for the people in California who hate everything that I do, say, and want. I elected you to be my advocate. So stop trying to help them and start trying to help me. That's what quid pro quo used to be. Now it's completely different when you talk politics. But back to the point. When you look at how things happen, I highly stress, I've written about this in my book, this is a big deal to me. I have practiced this as an investigator over the years. In fact, it complicated for me the last 15 or so years of my career as an investigator because I believed that it was really important that if I had the power to pass judgment on other people, that I had the power to permanently alter the rest of those people's lives, that I had to be able to see both sides of the argument. Even if I disagreed, I had to have an opportunity and ability to understand how they got there, what their decision-making processes were, how they got there. It didn't mean I had to agree, because remember, this is like the difference between acceptance and tolerance. I can tolerate your behavior, does not mean I accept it. This is critical, and these are conversations that have left the lexicon of the world that we live in. It has left the conversation because we don't even have conversation now. If you disagree, you're bad, you're horrible, you're this, you're that. That's the problem, and that's where we've come. One of the big problems that we run into with this is if you don't have a balance, if you don't look at things and work to try to be conscientious about your decisions, in the end, you will end up giving those who you are not fair and balanced to a cause to come back at you. And at some point, they will be the ones passing judgment on you that is not so fair and balanced. So that's really critical. Remember, you have a responsibility. With great power, you have great responsibility. So today, I have set up for your hopefully listening pleasure a guest who will be joining us shortly. She is quite skilled, quite experienced in the field of both farming and gardening and horticulture as a whole. And I've asked her to come on with us so that we can have a conversation, as of course we are currently in the spring planting mode right now. Whether it is that you are going to do a container garden or a full-blown garden, if you're going to do raised beds or whatever, if you want to do hobby gardening where you just do it because you want something to do cathartically outside, or if you're serious and you want to do a sustenance garden, whatever the case is, she is certainly well-versed enough that we can have the conversation. I asked her to join us around 6:20, so she'll be calling in shortly. Meanwhile, I had wanted to kind of run up to that a bit. You know, I've talked about it off and on before. I've just done a couple of classes on germination of seeds. That would be if you want to start your own plants. And then I talked about planning and setting up to plant and what to do and methodologies. I, of course, am very strong on raised bed and on hugel culture. Both of them are pretty heavily covered on my practicesselfreliance.com website under gardening. Check it out. I'm constantly adding new articles to it. But it's really important to understand a couple of basic premises. Whether you live in the city, if you have a balcony on the 20th floor, or you live in a condo or an apartment, almost all of them have something. You can buy a window box that you can hang off the edge, and unless they have a very specific clause in your lease that says you're not allowed to do it, you can hang it off of the edge and be able to grow at least some small things. You can put pots in the window if you have a sliding glass door to a patio, or if you have large windows somewhere in the apartment that get sun. even if it's in your bedroom. Open the curtain in the morning, put them on a rack, get a shelf, even if you buy a $20 plastic shelf, and you can grow herbs, tomatoes, whatever. You can buy grow lights. There are T5 lights. They are the ones that use a low temperature. They don't burn a lot of electricity. Light bulb that is a type of fluorescent grow lamp. You can get one at Walmart, a grow lamp from Furry Morris for, say, between $28 and $39. Put it on a timer, start it up, and start growing on your kitchen counter. You can grow your own herbs, grow basil, grow oregano, grow thyme, all things like that. When you want to go to fruiting and flowering, you're going to need a bit more room. So if you have none, think about pots. Maybe you can purchase yourself a couple of rollers for them. If you really are a little bit handy, you can get a piece of wood or get yourself a some kind of a tossed away grate from maybe an old bread basket or some bread crate. Put it on top of a Harbor Freight moving dolly that you can get on sale for like $10. You can wheel them in and out, put them in places. You can, if you have a balcony and there's a balcony above you, cut a deal with them. You can go right now to Home Depot. They have starter plants. They have tomato plants. They're called indeterminate. If you look along the mid-level of the tags, you'll see that they identify them as indeterminate. That means that they grow as a vine. Pretty much all of the nightshades, things like tomatoes and eggplant and all, they are all vining, cucumbers and such. You can cut a deal with your neighbor above you and run it up along the balcony to their next floor and run it up there to the next one for that matter, and you can all grow and have cucumbers or tomatoes or whatever throughout the season with very little space and a couple of pots. So I believe that we have Lisa. Lisa, are you with us?
I'm here. How are you?
Already. Ooh, we're getting some feedback. Interesting. So thank you for joining us. I gave them a little run-up. Can you give them a little of your background so that it's not coming from me? They can hear it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Oh, sure. Well, currently I work for a garden center here in South Jersey. Prior to that, I didn't have my own farm.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that, I was actually in corporate America.
Oh, there you go. You've run the gambit, like me. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's most people. It's funny because when people get to know you on the gardening side or in the horticultural side, they have all these preconceived notions. When I tell people that I spent most of my life as an investigator in the corporate environment all over the world, they scratch their head because they see, they see garb that doesn't fit the profile, and they always tend to make the mistake of judging the book by its cover. So when we met several years ago, I was quite impressed because of your balanced broad-mindedness, and that's why I've been bugging you to come on with me for the last 2 years. So I'm really happy that you finally got to.
Yeah, well, it's been a crazy couple of years, so I'm glad I'm finally able to.
Yeah. So we are, as I was saying before you came on, in the beginning stages of spring planting. And Lord knows, I guess because things are the way they are all the time, it wouldn't shock me if next week after I put in all my starters that, we'd have another snow. But just saying, we are there at the beginning of the spring planting season. So if people are going to do a garden, whether it is a hobby garden or a sustenance garden, this is the time. Get in early, get started, and get going. So right now you're ramping up there. You work at Dambly's. You're ramping up for that now, right?
Yes. We have all our cold crops in. We've actually had them in for a couple of weeks. And now we are just going to start getting tomatoes tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, it's just going to be a whirlwind of vegetables coming in for the next 2 weeks or so.
So let's explore that a little for the people who are just getting started with this or are not 100% confident at what they're doing. So cold weather crops, they begin with things like lettuce and cabbages, Brussels sprouts and whatnot. Why don't you kind of go over that a bit, if you would?
Yeah, most of the brassicas, which are your broccolis, cauliflowers, cabbages, kale, things that tend to, grow better in a cooler environment, and some that take a little bit longer, like your broccolis and cabbages, cauliflower, which need a little more of an extended season, but they don't do well if you plant them in the dead of the summer. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of vegetables that really need to be started early before you start getting into your warm weather crops.
Right. Now, do the cool weather crops, like for instance, when you do things like lettuces and whatnot, once you get to the point where you hit mid-May, early June, when it starts really heating up, they kind of taper off, right? And then they have a second season?
Right. They tend to bolt. Mm-hmm. They don't like warm weather, and you'll see that stalk coming up out of the center, and you're going to get your flower, your flower stalk, which is where your seed comes from. So if you're really ambitious, you can save seed. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, they do not like the warmer weather. There are some lettuces now that actually tolerate warmer temperatures.
Oh,
so
I've been planting and growing since the mid 60s, and the one thing I have never had any luck with is the lettuces thing, even the musculine and all that. None of them. I've never had any luck with it. I don't know why. It really frustrates me.
Well, there is one that's just amazing. It's called Nevada lettuce. Mm-hmm. That holds up so well in the dead of summer. It's really crazy. I mean, it's the crispiest, sweetest lettuce.
Wow. Now that's Nevada, like as in the state?
Yes, like
wow.
The state.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, is I'd assume that's some kind of a hybrid, right?
It is. It's not an heirloom. Mm-hmm. And I only know of one seed company that carries it.
Okay, so if we may, I'd like for you to elaborate for the listeners a little bit on the difference between heirloom, hybrid, and GMO, because a lot of people I've debated this with over the years, they really don't understand. They think that because something's a hybrid, that makes it the big evil GMO, and that's really not the case, in my understanding, right?
No, it's not. It's not that it's evil. There are a ton of organic hybrids out there. An heirloom is basically just that. It's a seed that has been in existence for 100 years or more. Mm-hmm. It's never been changed in any way. Mm-hmm. So it's a very old-fashioned vegetable.
Right.
When you're talking about hybrids, they may take, an heirloom or a new variety and put them together and create something new for disease resistance, heat tolerance, that sort of thing, flavor, mm-hmm. color. But it could be, 100% organic.
Right.
That's the difference. When you're talking about non-GMO hybrids, that's a different story.
Right. Right, because what people, and in a lot of the conversations that I've had with people over the past 6 months or so on this topic, they have missed the point that when they take a seed or they take a plant into the laboratory and they inject it with, say, wasp venom so that it will deter certain bugs, they are altering the DNA of the plant. That is a GMO plant.
Correct.
And then the seeds that come out of that carry that in its genetic code. What we're talking about when we talk about hybrid, all it's really funny because I've been in other places around the country and people talk about Rutgers hybrid this and Rutgers hybrid tomatoes and so forth and so on. And I always laugh because it's from here. And they see it as like this big thing in the sky, this thing. And it's really funny to me because it's so well known. But they've done all these hybrid where they'll bring two different types of tomatoes together and breed them together, cross-pollinate them so that they gain some of the value from the other. And that's important for people to understand. Now, in your where you're working right now, at least for the moment, one of the things that they have a lot of that you didn't really see that much before the last few years are these bag gardening, I don't even remember what they refer to, garden bags or whatever, where you put it down, you fill it with a bag of potting soil, and voila, you have an instant container garden.
Right, they're the smart pots, and they are really great for people who don't have wonderful growing conditions in their own soil. Maybe they have rocky soil, maybe they have depleted soil, and they just can't get out there to till in nutrients. I know a lot of older people love the grow bags because, mm-hmm. They just select their soil and they put it into the bag and they can just start growing right away. They also don't have to deal with, water issues as far as, this part of the ground is totally saturated and I can't get anything mm-hmm. to grow, or I'm dealing with mold, or, it's hard clay.
Mm-hmm.
These bags drain incredibly well because of what they're made of. Like I said, you can put whatever soil you choose into the bag, and you're off. I mean, it's a great concept.
Right. I think it's a really great idea because I think one of the barriers, I had someone stop me, at Home Depot in their garden center when I was in there to get some bags of dirt to amend, and they sent someone over to ask me questions. I thought it was kind of funny, and they had never gardened in their life. And I'd be curious what yours would be on that. But I said to them, look, where do you live? Well, we live in a very small place. It's a row home. I said, okay, here's what you do. Go buy two gardening bags, or get yourself a couple of large pots. Put them up and then fill them with a bag of soil and a bag of mulch or whatever, mix them together, plant. Get your hands dirty, get the feel for what it takes to grow something, get the feel for what it takes and what it feels like to have it actually yield, so that next year, because they wanted to go buy 25 bags of garden soil and build a raised bed, and it's my experience that if people try and they fail, which you're going to have problems, inevitably you're going to have problems. It's a learning curve. They'll walk away from it and never do it again. They had young children. This could be the beginning of something completely new to them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a very ambitious thing. It's great to say, oh, I'm going to start a garden. But not just a hobby gardenist, but from a sustainability standpoint, it is a constant, attention needing thing.
Yep.
You can go out and you can start your garden and not see a lot of results and get frustrated and walk away and it turns to weeds. So sometimes people take on a little too much, and those smart pots are a great way, like you said, just to kind of, get acclimated to it and see some results and get excited about it.
Yeah. I saw an interesting thing. I don't know if you've seen it ever, but I was down in Philadelphia last year, and I was roaming my way through from the back end off of 5th and Delaware Ave at the Asian market up toward 9th and Federal in the heart of the South Philly Italian, or what used to be the South Philly Italian section near Gino's and Pat's Steak. And there was a row home, actually two of them in a row. And there were these big corrugated metal containers, like the ones that they use for water troughs for horses,
mm-hmm.
filled with dirt. And they had drilled drain holes on the bottom. And they were growing, one had a fruit tree in it, and one had tomatoes growing in it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And mm-hmm. this was right on the road?
Right on the sidewalk, right against the front of the building at the row home. And, in the cities, there are lots of places in the cities that there's a term they use, which is called a food desert. There is nowhere to get fresh anything there. And I can't even fathom, because I'm so divorced. I mean, I know it because I've worked those areas heavily. But I can't fathom the mentality to want to live somewhere where my only selection for food for my family and myself is from 7-Eleven or the Quickie Mart down the street.
Right. I mean, it is a real struggle for people. And I know, you know, sometimes you don't have the, you know, the opportunity to live where you really want to live right away. You know, you have roadblocks and whatnot. So people who create these urban gardens and find ways to creatively grow their own food, I give them such congrats. I mean, because it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, feeding your family good, wholesome food is really the most important thing. I mean, you know, if you're not healthy, what do you have?
Right. And health has a lot to do with what you're ingesting. There's no question. And having no opportunity, that's what's so great about this push from the Ag Department, bringing in all these small local farm markets that are popping up all over. There's one in Haddonfield. There's one, I think, in Collingswood now. They have one in Runnymede now that opens up starting sometime in the next month or whatever, and they run up until the end of the harvest season. It's a great thing because it gets it into the hands of people who may not even have a vehicle, who walk down to the end of the street and ride the bus to go to work or wherever, and they can actually walk there to go get fresh produce. And people really don't understand how that affects the whole way that people live. It changes everything.
Oh, it absolutely does. And I know in Pennsylvania, there, because that's where I'm really originally from, they have started trucks now, produce trucks, specifically, you know, with small farms, you know, putting their produce on these trucks, and they'll drive to these food desert areas, and they will give out the food. I mean, I think that's fantastic. They're making an effort.
Yeah, it's and this is the whole thing. When we work together, when we compromise, give, take a little, everyone is better off and everyone learns. And someone asked me yesterday very pointedly why I'm spending, or my interpretation was, wasting so much time on doing my garden. I have a very good-sized garden with quite a number of hugel mounds and 4x4 raised beds, along with some other things. It takes up 2/3 of my backyard, which is quite large. I could feed a small army with what comes out of it each year, even when I screw up half of what I do. But, you know, and it struck me because, you know, you never really think about how you're going to answer that. You do what you feel is right for you. But when someone else asks, at first, my response is, I'm sorry, why does it matter? But okay, I get it. So let me think about how I can answer this question. And to me, because I teach survival and preparedness, my answer is, if something really happened, right now, Ted Koppel's book is going crazy, even though it came out over a year and some ago. He interviewed people from the last administration in the DHS and the Energy Department, and they all admitted what we know in the industry, on preparedness industry, that they fear. They had several exercises where they estimated between 3 and 9 million, then some estimates upped as high as 90 million who would die if they had a 90-day problem where power was out from, say, Boston to D.C., because that's one of the main grid areas. And when you start realizing that, you start to pick it apart, because I'm a risk manager. When I do, one of the primary reasons for that is because people wouldn't have food and they have no skills. And then people say to me, well, I'll just grow something. Really? Have you ever grown anything? Do you know how to grow something? What does it take to grow something? Do you have the soil? Do you have the seeds? Do you have this? Do you have that? If you want to germinate, do you know how to germinate? I did two classes recently on germination of seeds. It's simple if you've done it a few times. But if not, you're pretty in trouble. And I love these people talk about how they're going to do that. That's why it's worthy to come to someone like you. you're knowledgeable, you can walk them through, tell them how to get started and get the feel. You know, what's your take on that? I mean, have you had people say to you, oh, well, I'll garden if I have to, or...
Well, I think what's interesting is we have a lot of people who will come into the store and they think they want to start a garden, but they've never done it before. You know, and we guide them through that, like you said. I mean, we'll start from seed and how to germinate seed and how to plant the starter pots and whatnot, all the way up through, you know, how to can what you've produced. You know, I find that more and more people are coming in who really do have an understanding of what's going on out there. Mm-hmm. And they are knowledgeable, very knowledgeable. And you can tell that it's something that they've just sort of started coming to that realization and understanding what's going on and that things can't really keep going the way that they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And surprisingly, a lot of older people, which, you know, really, really surprised me. I had a gentleman in his 80s the other day who
wow.
came to me and said, you know, I'm sick of this GMO stuff. And, you know, and he was just very vocal about the whole thing. And, you know, I was really happy to see that. I mean, it's not just, you know, the Gen Xers or whoever who's starting to get a clue about this. It's older adults as well. And I think that's, you know, when you start seeing anything in mass like that, that's when you start to see change.
I agree, and I think it's very healthy. The people who listen to me and go to my classes, they hear me say it almost like a broken record. But, you know, one of my most popular articles I've had on my one website for years is that your grandparents were preppers, basically. I mean, let's face it. You know, back in the old days, that's how it was. People don't really realize that less than 100 years ago, there were not refrigerators that didn't require putting a block of ice in the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's stunning the way the world has changed. I mean, I've said it a million times. People hear me say this, they're probably going, oh, brother, here he goes again. But, I mean, my grandmother would sit us on the back porch, hand us a gigantic bowl full of green beans and say, snap them and break the ends off and put them in this other bowl. We were the free slave labor, the kids, and then she would can for a day. And that,
yep.
You know, we'd go in the basement. There'd be wooden shelves with a dirt floor and the, you know, the rock walls, and voila, it's 58 degrees with no electricity. Everything stays good. You keep it out of the light. It's all cool. And all year long, we ate that until the next time we went back to go do it all over again. That was how things were. People have become so divorced from being able to take care of themselves that when I talk to them about raising chickens and rabbits for meat, they flip out because they don't want to know about that. Well, they come from somewhere. And when you get it at the market, that someone did that. It's just not you. And it's the same thing with the produce. The difference is, for instance, right now, still 99% of what people get when they go to the grocery store are coming from Chile and Peru and Mexico, where things are not quite done the same way as what you would do in your backyard, even in your worst day.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Very true. You know, when I had my farm in Pennsylvania, I had a CSA. And I, you know, aside from the vegetables, I also raised rabbits. I raised chickens, you know, for meat as well as eggs. I had goats. And people who would come to the farm to pick up their share or just come visit, you know, they would look at me and say, wait a minute, you know, last year you were wearing a suit and now you're slaughtering a chicken. I don't understand. I mean, how does this happen? And, you know, I'm not going to say it wasn't a difficult thing for me to do the first time, but, you know, you have to look at the bigger picture here and you know, like you said, it comes from somewhere. And in this case, it was coming from me. So.
Right. And just for the listeners' edification, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture.
And yes, correct.
It's a fantastic thing. And the really interesting thing is people who live in the city will cut a deal to get into the CSAs. And it's a boon for small farmers. It's a boon for them. It's a win-win, which is my favorite thing. You know, city residents have direct access to high-quality fresh produce grown locally or in the region. They basically are purchasing a share of the vegetables that come from a regional farmer's farm. You as the farmer, you have the stability of knowing there's a market for it. You don't have to kill yourself making the market. It's already basically sold before you get there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, it's not to say that it's not a struggle sometimes to find customers, because depending on, you know, where you are, you know, I run across more people who have no clue what CSA means than people who do. So there, it's really education. You know, you've got to be talking about it all the time and explaining what it is. And when people understand, you know, their perspective changes. I mean, one of the things that I did, I also had a stand at a local farmer's market where I would sell extra produce. But I would lay out on the table the bag that I gave them in a CSA package with the vegetables for that week. And I did the breakdown of what the cost is. And when people would come up to the table, I'd say, could you do that at, you know, Super Fresh or Giant or wherever you shop? Could you do this for organic produce? And 9 times out of 10, they would say, no, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this is coming right out of that farm over there. It's not coming off a boat or a truck.
Right, and you know who's giving it to you. You know its origin.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's such a great thing, and I hope that over the next few years, I've seen a pretty remarkable influx of people and interest and understanding of it, not necessarily specifically CSAs, but also with these local farm marts. I was talking about it before I brought you on, about how these different, you know, ones have all popped up around. It's moving in the right direction. It's Haddon Township passing a law, an ordinance, to allow a limited number of chickens on properties in residential areas. Now, in Runnymede, in Belmar, and some of the others, they still fall under what I think is one of the worst laws they've ever done, which passed in 1999 in New Jersey, but they were done all over the country, which was the livestock laws, and it banned all livestock on any property unless it was 100 acres or more, I think is what it was, if I recall correctly. It's pretty oppressive. So ostensibly making criminals out of anyone who wants to raise rabbits, raise chickens, raise whatever for sustenance. And when there was that big thing that happened last year and they killed, I think it added up, I forget, it was over 1.5 million, I think, by the time they got done. It may have been way more than that, I forget, of the chickens all being destroyed across 15 states when they said there was Asian, the Asian flu or whatever was there. And there was a sudden shortage of eggs, and suddenly some townships and municipalities started passing amendments to their laws to allow limited numbers of chickens so that they could get eggs at the local point, which I think is such a great thing, you know, but it just hasn't really hit because people have this consumerist mentality and don't want to be bothered, but they don't mind barking dogs and revving cars.
Right, exactly. And I'm also very surprised. We, you know, we sell chickens as well, you know, baby chicks.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of people who've come in and said, oh, my township just passed a, you know, an ordinance where we're allowed to have them now. And, you know, I think that's great. I mean, you know, people should have the freedom to raise their own food. And they, you know, I get it. Maybe you don't want, you know, a cow in the, you know, 1 acre property next door to your, you know, $500,000 home. But, you know, you know, the smell alone might be a little bit much, but you know, having a little handful of chickens certainly isn't hurting anyone.
Right, I agree. You know, the problem is, in the world as it is, and this is one of my recurring topics, but, you know, we're up against two completely different mentalities. As I break it down, it's urban and rural. if people in the suburbs, some of them have a foot in the rural side, and others have their foot firmly planted in the urban side. And the urban ones, they're all about, you know, I don't want you painting your door a different color than mine because it doesn't make the street match, and I'm anal retentive, and you're not allowed to have a flag out on the front unless it has this dimension and that color pole and this and that. So having chickens or rabbits is just a complete outrage to them. And that's where we're up against with people who have a rural mentality, who don't have sidewalks, who don't really give a flying fling about what color your front door is. As long as there's not a sofa out on your front yard, you're pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, like you said, I mean, there's definitely a shift happening, even though it might be a slow one. I think people are starting to understand it and appreciate it. I mean, you can see that just from, you know, commercials that are going on now. I mean, how many products are you seeing on the shelf now that you never in a million years would have thought would have been non-GMO? Yeah. I went to the store the other day. It kills me because I search high and low for an organic mayonnaise that I can afford that's not $10 a jar. And I went into ShopRite the other day, and there was Hellmann's organic mayonnaise.
Wow. You know,
they're coming around slowly. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, they see market share that they may be missing out on, and that's their motivation. But, you know, at least it's giving people a little more choice, and it's opening up the market a little bit, and it's making people more aware. Because when you start seeing that on the shelf, you have to question and say, why? Why is there an organic mayonnaise? And, you know, one thing leads to another. You start reading. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And before you know it, you're a very knowledgeable person about sustainability and you know, the whole organic process and food and, you know, where it all comes from.
Yeah. Well, you know, and really, not to go political, because I don't mean to be political, but in the overall picture, this is what people need to understand. There's some really heavy underlying arguments that are going on, and they have been for a number of years, you know, bashing capitalism, free market, and they use them simultaneously. But a free market capitalist world, I've been in 100-plus countries. Every place that has a real free market capitalism working, people are freer and happier. What they eat, how they live, is better. And when you see when the government doesn't tamper with picking winners and losers, you actually see things like this happen. Like McDonald's. Just, I don't know if you saw, but a while back in 2015, they basically announced that they're moving to go to antibiotic-free poultry, and they're going to range free-range chickens and eggs and whatnot. Well, this is changing the environment for the people who are going to be able to provide to them, and it has the opportunity to allow small producers to be able to provide within reason, and it's a big deal. It's really a big deal.
It is. It's good to see. It really is.
It is. And I think it's interesting, too, that when you see the way these things work, that you see how people will, and it's like a pendulum. They'll go one way really hard. They go the other way really hard. Unfortunately, they rarely stop in the middle in a balanced perspective of saying, well, we have to do this. We want that. So we'll find a way to do it in the middle. But I think you're right in the fact that we're seeing it move more and more to where now they're going to be under pressure. That's what the free market does. It washes out the people who ignore what the buyers and the consumers want. And if you educate the consumers, or if they get educated somehow, some other way, they're going to start demanding things that are better for them than sponge rubber chicken nuggets and, you know, chickens that have, you know, glow in the dark. I mean, it's relative. It's going to happen. And that's why I think this whole topic is so important. So what other kind of goodies do you have going in there? I did want to touch, before we run out of time, on some ideas about how to, without going all chemical company side of it, to control things like pests in your garden. Like I pitch really hard using things like marigolds and others for companion planning. What do you have to offer or input on that?
Well, yeah, companion planning is a wonderful thing. As far as pests go, you know, sometimes you have really bad pest pressure, other times you won't. It really depends on the weather, it depends on the season. You know, I find things like mint is planting mint around, which, yes, can be invasive, so maybe you want to plant that in a pot and not in your garden, you know, per se. But mint is wonderful for keeping pests away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on my farm, I was a hand picker. You know, I went down there with the, you know, the tape rolled backward on my hand, and I went over the leaves, and I took all the eggs off, and, I was pretty old school.
I'd say that definitely qualifies you as old school. Holy moly.
But you know what? There was something satisfying about seeing all those bugs on the tape and throwing it in the trash can.
I can see you now coming back with your entire arm wrapped in, you know, Gorilla tape and 4 million little green worms on your arms all wriggling around stuck to the tape.
Hey, there's worse ways to kill an afternoon, right?
It's, you know, and see, that's the thing, like, that's the other part of it, which was part of my answer yesterday when I was asked that, is it's cathartic. When everything else around you in the world is going to hell in a handbag, to walk out, get your hands dirty, look, you know, smell the air, see the, you know, dig, make something happen, and then when all of a sudden you turn around and go, holy crap, look at that, there's 50 tomatoes, there's 400. Last year, I had every problem under the sun. And every problem under the sun, late in, all kinds of problems with my soil amendments, everything you could think of, even when I knew all of it, it still went wrong. And yet, by the time I hit August, there were so many tomatoes, I lost hundreds of them because I couldn't get to them quick enough.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's amazing how that works sometimes when I think we tend to overthink things sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're dealing with nature, you got to go with it. You can't fight it. It's going to do what it's going to do. And you just have to learn to roll with the punches. And usually, you know, things work out okay.
So a couple of quick things before we run out of time. We probably only have about 5 or 6 minutes left. We were talking the other day about this, about Epsom salt, and I tried something last year that was reasonably good, that was milk, and I forget what was, something else was in it, and ways to combat common problems that you get with the squashes and the cucumbers and whatnot, the powdery mildew and others. Could you elaborate on that really quickly?
You know what, Will? You got all garbled right at the end. All I heard was Epsom salt
and okay.
Milk, and then I lost you.
Oh, okay. Milk, and yeah, you were picket fencing, so it's the connection between us, I think. The milk, Epsom salt, things to deal with things like powdery mildew and other things like that that are naturals that aren't going to screw up the balance in the garden.
Right, right. Epsom salt is a wonderful thing. You know, the other thing that is really great is calcium and magnesium, especially for blossom end rot on your peppers and tomatoes. You know, if you put that into your soil, spray it on the plant itself, your blossom end rot problem goes way, way down. That's one that I would highly recommend. You know, your calcium substitute can be crushed eggshells. You know, if you eat eggs in the morning, just hang on to them. Crush them up, get them in the soil. You know, things like, you know, neem oil. I know a lot of people are big proponents of neem oil. That does tend to be very effective for a lot of different pests. You know, there's such a gamut of things out there. I know.
How about things like coffee grounds? How about things like coffee grounds and baking soda?
I have never used baking soda myself. I have used coffee grounds. They've actually, you know, I don't know if I can say one way or another whether they were very beneficial, because I put that in my compost as a normal normal amendment. I never just put the coffee grounds in. So I kind of did it, but did it in a different way. I'm kind of a firm believer that if you start with healthy soil, the pest problem or the disease problem shouldn't be as bad if your soil is healthy to begin with. So I'm not a big proponent of, you know, fertilizers and whatnot, because, you know, starting with healthy soil, that's really pretty much all you need, unless you have some kind of really big issue.
Right. And then, so like the smart, you said they're called smart bags, I think?
Smart pots, yeah.
Smart pots. So the bag, the garden bags, whatever, depending upon the brand that you're getting, that's a great reason why starting there first gets you the feel for what it takes to maintain, to water, to harvest, to trim and prune and all that kind of stuff. Gets you started, gets your feet wet so that you don't have a big investment and you don't get frustrated, so that the next year you can grow and evolve into a real garden if you have the opportunity. It's a really great thing. Well, I really appreciate you spending time with us, Lisa. And I have a link up on today's show page to go to Dambly's. And if you have anything else you'd like me to link to, I'll add that too if you drop me a line, and then we'll go from there. But I want to thank you again. Before we go, I did want to touch on one other quick thing. You were about to make a really big move and go to Tennessee, right?
Yes, I am.
So in a couple of short, quick minutes, tell me, how did you decide on the location where you're going?
I knew that I wanted to be in Eastern Tennessee. We knew that for family purposes, as well as, the overall geography and environment of the area. So, you know, that's something we've discussed long and hard for a few years now. So that the area was pretty easy to decide. You know, then we just had to sort of nail it down with specifics like, you know, schools and access to, you know, my fiance's job and, you know, all of that. So you just kind of narrow until you pinpoint.
And then once you found your target, did you go down and visit there before you bought, or?
Yes, we did. I had never been to Tennessee before in my life.
Wow.
Yep. So we went down and we spent about a week. Our realtor was amazing and really tolerated a lot with us. She was very patient, did a lot of driving, and we, you know, she was very knowledgeable. So really getting, if you know nothing about an area that you want to move to, find people who are knowledgeable, who can share their knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So before you go down there, you've got to send me your email address, because if you change phones, I'll lose track of you, because I want to track you and bring you on the air to talk about the change in environment. Because this is really a big deal in the preparedness groups. People talk all the time about leaving the city or leaving this area and going to the country, and they really don't grasp the concept of what that takes.
No, and I mean, that is part of the reason why we're moving. I mean, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania. I'm in New Jersey temporarily. But, you know, I'm kind of tired of being priced out of life. You know, the real estate taxes, the cost of the homes, and what you're getting in return for what you are paying.
I'm with you.
To me, it's just a treadmill, and it's not one that I want to be on anymore.
No argument there, and I think there's a lot of us who agree, but pulling the trigger to go do that is quite a complicated matter, that's for sure.
Oh, it is. It's not a simple thing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us. You're so articulate and so knowledgeable, and I really appreciate you sharing with the listeners, and we're going to get you back on to talk about your new adventure when you get down in Tennessee.
Oh, well, thank you, Will. I would love to. It's going to be an adventure that I will definitely share.
All righty. Well, we will talk to you again soon. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you later on.
All right. Have a great night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All righty. So I hope that that's of some use for everyone to be able to get a handle on what it takes and how some ideas for putting together your spring planting, doing a garden, because it is important. I think It's both valuable and it's a learning experience to help you in your way of being more prepared and more capable. It's so important to literally have some experience doing these things, because if you ever really need to do it, it's too late to figure it all out once you get there. It's now. Every day, everything. I was having this discussion earlier today. I think it's so critically important. You can have all the knowledge in the world, but without hands-on experience, without having put your hands in it, putting yourself directly in it and immersing yourself, you will never get it right. It is critical. Like I always say, the fact of the matter is, there is no disaster when you're prepared. Until next week, I'm Will Hemingway. We'll see you.
And that, unfortunately, will be it for this edition of the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. I am your host, Will Hemingway. Thank you for spending your time with us today. Don't forget to click the links at the top of practicepreparedness.com, to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and meetup.com. Until next time, please don't wait until it's too late. Live proactively. Act with purpose every day. Have a plan and practice. Because, as I always say, there is no disaster when you are prepared. We hope that you'll join us next time for the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. Have a good day. And that, unfortunately, will be it for this edition of the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. I am your host, Will Hemingway. Thank you for spending your time with us today. Don't forget to click the links at the top of practicepreparedness.com, to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and meetup.com. Until next time, please don't wait until it's too late. Live proactively. Act with purpose every day. Have a plan and practice. Because, as I always say, there is no disaster when you are prepared. We hope that you'll join us next time for the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. Have a good day.